com. You'll be glad you did.
This is VOA News, reporting via remote. I'm Jeff Custer. A senior Ukrainian official in the eastern city of Slovyansk in Donetsk province says the city has been hit by massive shelling from Russian forces. Associated Press correspondent Charles Diledesma reports.
Day after Russian President Vladimir Putin declared victory in seizing an eastern Ukraine province essential to his wartime aims, Moscow's offensive maintains sustained bombardments across urban centers. The mayor of Slovyansk has reported sustained shelling of the city, which had a pre-war population of about 107,000. He's urging residents to take cover in shelters instead of trying to evacuate. The barrage underscores fears that Russian forces are positioning to advance further into Ukraine's Donbass region. I'm Charles Diledesma.
Meanwhile, a two-day international conference held in Lugano, Switzerland, aimed at helping Ukraine rebuild after Russia's invasion, concluded Tuesday, with conferees making commitments and agreeing to a series of principles designed to guide the nation's recovery. Representatives from more than 40 countries and international organizations such as the European Investment Bank and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development signed the conference declaration. The signatories made commitments to provide political, financial, and technical support and establish what they're calling Lugano Principles to guide the reconstruction effort, which Ukraine's prime minister says could cost up to $750 billion. Signatories, including the United States, Britain, France, and Japan, also condemned Russia's military aggression in the strongest possible terms and urged Moscow to withdraw its troops without delay. This is VOA News. Britain's finance and health ministers resigned Tuesday in what may be a final blow for embattled Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who tried to apologize for the latest scandal involving a sexual misconduct complaint regarding one of his ministers. Health Secretary Sajid Javid announced his resignation in a statement, saying he could no longer continue in good conscience. Moments later, Finance Minister Rishi Sunak also announced he was quitting. The resignations came as Johnson was apologizing for what he said was a mistake by not realizing that former whip Chris Pincher was unsuitable for a job in government after complaints of sexual misconduct were made against him. In interviews with a British broadcaster, Johnson said, "In hindsight, it was the wrong thing to do. I apologize to everyone who's been badly affected by it." A new poll suggests that many U.S. residents do not expect to rely on the digital services and practices that became commonplace during the COVID-19 pandemic once it's fully behind them. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
That's even as many think it's a good thing if those options remain available in the future. The new poll comes from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. It shows close to half or more of U.S. adults say they are not likely to attend virtual activities, receive virtual health care, have groceries delivered, or use curbside pickup after the pandemic ends. Still, close to half of adults also say it would be a good thing if virtual options continue. For many, though, drawbacks outweigh the benefits of relying on digital services in the future. I'm Julie Walker.
President Joe Biden Tuesday bestowed the nation's highest military honor to four Army soldiers for their heroism above and beyond the call of duty during the Vietnam War. Biden presented the Medal of Honor to Staff Sergeant Edward N. Kinshiro, Specialist 5 Dwight W. Birdwell, Specialist 5 Dennis M. Fuji, and retired Major John J. Duffy. Speaking in the East Room of the White House, Biden praised their heroism and lamented that they hadn't received appropriate recognition until now. He said, "Today, we're setting the record straight." Kinshiro died in 1967 of a gunshot wound in Vietnam and was being given the award posthumously for his actions during a December 1, 1966 raid. Oklahoma City lawyer Dwight Birdwell was honored for his actions in helping to head off an assault and evacuate wounded at Tan Son Nhut Air Base near Saigon in 1968, despite injuries to his torso and face. Fuji was presented with the medal for actions over 4 days in February of 1971 when he treated wounded and directed airstrikes against enemy positions after his air ambulance was forced to crash land. Duffy's awards for leading troops who came under ambush after their commander was killed. Repeating the hour's top news story, a senior Ukrainian official in the eastern city of Slovyansk says the city has been hit by massive shelling from Russian forces. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. This.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Leading to more hunger and more distress as people are forced to resort to extreme measures to put food on the table.
That was Lisa Schlein in Geneva reporting on a looming hunger crisis in the Central African Republic. Details coming up also. The presidents of the DRC and Rwanda will meet for talks in the Angolan capital Luanda tomorrow. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The French medical aid group Doctors Without Borders reports a jump in cases of malnourished Nigerian children at its Maiduguri Nutrition Center in the country's northeast. The group, known by its French acronym MSF, said it was seeing a record number of child patients ahead of Borno State's lean season. MSF called it a big flashing warning sign that this year's hunger gap could be much more severe than in the past and called for an urgent response. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Doctors Without Borders, in a press release last Friday, said it had recorded an unprecedented influx of malnourished children in their treatment centers between May and June, the highest levels since commencing their project in northeastern Nigeria 5 years ago. MSF said it had so far this year admitted 2,140 malnourished children, about 50% higher than cases treated the year before. MSF said a third of the children were from displaced families barely getting by. The group warned that cases could worsen between July and September, the so-called lean season, usually when the highest cases of malnourished children are reported every year. MSF called for immediate action to reverse the negative trends. Hitecht Anki is MSF's Nigerian coordinator.
Why we are saying this now is because this year we have been seeing very early, even though we are not in this lean period. So that's why we would like to call for this urgent upscale of activity to prevent the future deterioration of the situation in the area.
MSF responded to the increased malnutrition by extending the capacity of its treatment center from 120 beds to 200 beds. MSF said its outpatient therapeutic feeding program has also seen a 25% increase in enrollment compared with last year. A camp secretary of the Kawarmaila camp in Borno State, Bukar Bukar, said AIDS hardly gets to them these days, despite increasing numbers of children suffering from malnutrition there.
In our camp, they are already withdrawing to give the food. That is the reason that the child they have malnutrition. Last year, we get food, we get everything. One dish of the mess is 700 naira. Nobody go to the market and get even 700 naira. And even last week, some people are go to Bama to go to farming. This Boko Haram, they kill even two or three people.
For years, malnutrition has been a concern in the conflict-affected Borno State, but trends have been exacerbated by the cumulative impact of insecurity, displacements, a recent surge in food prices, poverty, and lack of access to health care. Peter Hawkins is UNICEF's Nigeria country director.
The current ability to respond to that is fairly robust. Insecurity incidences of where capacity might be compromised makes that response mechanism very fragile. We are concerned that our ability to be able to respond to acute malnutrition, if it is compromised, the situation could deteriorate very, very quickly.
MSF says Nigeria need not only increase intervention and medical response, but also address other health issues such as measles, cholera, and disease outbreaks that could affect children and worsen the situation. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The powerful Tunisian labor union, which had more than 1 million members, initially supported the power grab of President Kais Saied a year ago. However, its head said the new constitution that the president altered could threaten democracy, and the union gave its members the choice of voting on the constitution in a referendum scheduled for July 25th, while totally rejecting the economic reforms that Saied suggested to secure a rescue loan from the IMF. Mongi Daoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, explained the labor union's position towards the draft and the economic reform to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Let's not forget that the UGTT has supported Kais Saied in his July 25th power grab. And they said that that is a correction that needs to be made, and they stood behind the president for doing so. But they kept watching and hoping that they would play maybe a strong role, an important role in that process, in their support to Kais Saied. However, Kais Saied rejected their call for an inclusive dialogue. He rejected a call for including them in a meaningful consultation on the process, even on this new writing of the Constitution. They felt that the invitation was just merely a window dressing, and they were actually right, because we see now what happened with those who took part in this consultation and this Kais Saied's dialogue. And so they felt that they are in a no man's land. So they are supportive of July 25th change, but at the same time, they're not in support of what Kais Saied is doing. They are also mirrored with a lot of divisions within them. Some of them, because of either political positions or ideological positions, they are opposed to some of the main political parties, especially Ennahda and others. And they are afraid if they are stand strong against Kais Saied, Ennahda will come back to power. And so therefore, they found themselves choosing not to take a stand and allowing their members to choose whether to participate in the referendum with no or yes, or just stay out of the process altogether.
Another contradiction between the labor union and the president is the IMF is resuming talks with Tunisia for a rescue loan, but the UGTT rejected the government economic reform plan that the IMF required. What could that lead to?
Well, that's an interesting point, because like you said, the UGTT has been opposed to the reforms that the IMF has suggested, and that the Tunisian government itself has accepted and put forward a plan that was welcomed by the IMF, but it was rejected by the UGTT. But I think the IMF, at least from the last statement that they put out, that they're going to start the conversation and the negotiations with the Tunisian government without mentioning anything about the UGTT, but they still hinted that it would be better for Tunisia and the Tunisian government to include UGTT in the conversation. So it's for us, it's a wait and see. UGTT has still made a very strong statement only a few days ago, rejecting those reforms and signaling that they will not be signing off on any of the loans coming up from IMF.
That was Mongi Daoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Today, Tunisia's president, Kais Saied, said his proposed constitution would not restore authoritarian rule, hitting back at criticism, and urged people to support it in this month's referendum. The president's supporters say he is standing up to elite forces whose bungling and corruption have condemned Tunisia to a decade of political paralysis and economic stagnation. In a letter published online, Saied wrote, "The proposed constitution was no danger to Tunisians' rights and freedoms." Mali's government today said 22 migrants from Mali, including three children, have died off the coast of Libya. The government said the victims were part of a group of 83 migrants stuck on a distressed vessel since June 22. Of those, 61 were rescued, including some Malians, with the help of the United Nations Migration Agency, the IOM. Also today, two Egyptians with the United Nations peacekeeping force in northern Mali were killed and five severely wounded by a bomb. The UN peacekeeping mission said the incident took place between the village of Tassalit and the city of Gao. The peacekeepers are in the country to battle insecurity that has grown since Islamist insurgents who took root in its arid north a decade ago escalated attacks and seized territory. The World Food Program warns the Central African Republic is facing unprecedented levels of food insecurity due to conflict, population displacement, widespread poverty, and underemployment. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
WFP officials say they anticipate a sharp increase in commodity prices this year and extending well into 2023. They say the price of rice is expected to rise by 30%, wheat flour by 67%, and vegetable oil by a staggering 70%. That, they note, will make staple food products unaffordable for millions of people, leading to more hunger and more distress as people are forced to resort to extreme measures to put food on the table. WFP spokesman Thompson Fury says 2.2 million people are food insecure in CAR.
The figure might not shock you out of your seats, but when you look at the population size, that's nearly half the population of the Central African Republic. And the country now joins the League of Nations such as Afghanistan, Yemen, South Sudan with highest proportion of acutely food insecure.
As less food becomes available, Fury says more children will suffer from malnutrition. UNICEF says the number of severely acutely malnourished children under age 5 is expected to rise in the country by 10% this year to 69,000. Children suffering from the condition are at risk of dying if they do not get the right medical and nutritional care. Fury says the WFP is struggling to provide the food and specialized treatment needed by children, women, and other vulnerable people in the CAR, and a lack of money is hindering those efforts.
Our costs of operating are skyrocketing. The United Nations World Food Program is appealing urgently for $68.4 million without immediate funding. Food and nutrition insecurity will only increase for millions of people.
Fury says the challenges facing the CAR are well documented and predate the crisis in Ukraine. But noting the impact of the war on rising commodity and fuel prices, he says humanitarian assistance will be required well beyond this year and into 2023. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Felix Tshisekedi and his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, will meet for talks in the Angolan capital, Luanda, this week, according to media reports quoting two Congolese officials and one Rwandan official. The two countries have been at diplomatic loggerheads since the M23 rebel group resumed fighting against Congolese troops in the east of the country near the Rwandan border. Kinshasa accuses Rwanda of backing M23, which Kigali denies. David Himbara is an educator, author, and professor of international development at Centennial College in Toronto, Canada. Previously, he worked for Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, as the head of strategy and policy in the office of the president and as the principal private secretary to the president. Douglas Mpuga reached him in Toronto for a comment on what to expect from this meeting.
I have seen this kind of so-called reconciliation talk or the discussion talk. If I remember correctly, the same, at one time it was President of Angola and President of DRC mediating who? President Kagame of Rwanda and President of Museveni of Uganda. As we know, nothing came of that. It was back and forth, zero came out. So this one will be the same because, you see,
Mediation requires two parties that are genuine, frank, and open, genuinely seeking a solution to a problem. That is what mediation requires. But if I look at these two individuals being mediated, they're not anywhere close to being prepared for kind of mediation.
The M23 accusations, which Rwanda denies, is the latest spark in all this, but also Rwanda accuses DRC of harboring insurgents. So can the two leaders figure out a way of solving this?
Yes, like I just said, the two parties are beginning with denials. If Rwanda is saying that it's not involved and that it is not supporting M23, so there you go. So what would the mediation be about if the party does not acknowledge what the problem is? It's a dead end.
And then what do you make of this parallel meeting, since both Kagame and Tshisekedi were recently in Nairobi to discuss the same issue?
That is basically emphasizing the what we just spoken about, preparedness to confront the matter. Here you have East African community seeking a solution led by President Kenyatta. Both Rwanda and now DRC are members of this African community. So it appears to me that that is a proper forum. That's a proper framework of solving this problem. So by jumping into this Angola-led mediation, which came via the African Union, if you cannot solve the problem in your own home base, in your own locality of East African community, so how then will you solve this problem by now going outside?
David Himbara is an educator, author, and professor of international development at Centennial College in Toronto, Canada. He spoke to my colleague Douglas Mpuga. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. And to all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Some Sudanese political parties welcomed yesterday's announcement by Military Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan the army is stepping back from the government. Al-Burhan said the military will withdraw from United Nations mediated talks and allow political and revolutionary factions to form a civilian transitional government. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Khartoum.
In a televised address on Monday evening, military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan suspended the participation of the military in talks led by the United Nations and a regional bloc aimed at ending the country's political deadlock. Protests demanding an end to military rule continued in and around Khartoum since Thursday, when mass demonstrations by tens of thousands were met by a stiff crackdown. Pro-democracy medics said at least 10 protesters were killed. Al-Burhan called on Sudanese political and revolutionary forces to engage in talks to form an independent government that will complete the task of the transitional period. Once the executive arm of government is formed, Al-Burhan said, the Sovereign Council will be dissolved and a Supreme Council of the Armed Forces will be formed to assume the supreme command of regular forces. He urged citizens to remain calm.
I call upon the various components of the Sudanese people, especially the youth, to adhere to peace. The right to express opinions is guaranteed to all. The sacrifices you have made are appreciated, and the realization of your hopes and aspirations for the democratic transition.
On October 25th last year, Al-Burhan staged a military coup, dissolving the transitional government formed after the military ousted longtime President Omar al-Bashir following a popular uprising that began in 2019. Protests have continued since that time. The UN and the African Union have led mediation efforts to break the deadlock amid the country's economic crisis. Al-Burhan said the army will not stand in the way of a democratic transition. Kamal Omar, a leader in the Islamic Popular Congress Party, says the decision was necessary as the country faces what he calls a constitutional vacuum. Omar says political parties must use this time to reach a consensus and achieve the objectives of the revolution.
There is no constitutional court, no high judicial council, and no high prosecution council. Therefore, we as political parties are required amidst the challenging political situation in our country to move forward with the dialogue and achieve the aspiration of our people who are longing for democracy and freedoms.
Political analyst Abdulmunem Himid says the announcement was expected as Al-Burhan is facing major political challenges and has failed to lead the country over the past 9 months. He says Al-Burhan was trying to find an exit strategy after orchestrating the coup.
Al-Burhan confirmed the failure of his government and regretted the killing of the people. Indeed, he doesn't want to hand over power to civilians, but wants to gain time, especially as he is facing major crimes, crime of leading a coup.
The Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition, a consortium of political parties in Sudan, are expected to comment on Al-Burhan's announcement at a news conference today. For VOA News, I'm Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Malawi's National Organization for Nurses and Midwives says about 2,000 nurses will leave the country this year for jobs in Saudi Arabia and the United States. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's National Organization of Nurses and Midwives says that currently more than 3,000 trained nurses in Malawi are unemployed. Shout Smeza is president of the organization.
We feel the pinch that the unemployed nurses and midwives have gone through and are going through. You know, having graduated with the qualification, having been licensed to practice, you know, for over 5 years without being recruited is not an easy way of doing things. It is a pity that our system is not matching in terms of the labor market and the service, the job that we have at hand.
Smeza says the first group of 1,000 nurses is expected to leave for Saudi Arabia this August.
To state, we are working on a memorandum of understanding now, the MOU, which depicts that we will be, as Malawi, sending 1,000 nurses every year for a project of 5 years.
George Jobin is the executive director for the Malawi Health Equity Network. He's concerned the nurses going abroad do not know enough about the jobs they are taking.
You also look at their welfare. Who else has gone to such countries and check the facilities, health facilities they work and under what conditions? These are some of the issues. But paramount to everything is that we wished these were recruited right here.
But Smeza says the organization has received assurances.
Here in Malawi, we will have a paperwork signed by Ministry of Labor, the Minister of Labor, ourselves and as an organization, Minister of Health, and the agent. The other side too, so we are looking at the Saudi Arabia as a government, and then the agent plus the responsible ministers that side.
Government statistics show that 65% of nursing positions in public hospitals in Malawi remain vacant. Dorothy Ngoma is the advisor to the president on maternal mortality and reproductive health. Ngoma, who is also a former president of the Nurses Organization, warns that unless the government finds a way to boost pay for nurses, many more will leave the country.
What will happen is even the ones that are in the mainstream would choose to quit government jobs here and go to U.S. and earn more money. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it definitely might cause brain drain. And that's not good for Malawi.
However, the Malawi government says it cannot hire more nurses now because of financial constraints. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Pete Hunley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.